This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Ghost Notebooks by Ben Dolnick. Read for you by Graham Halstead and a full cast. For Elise and Nishant, Handrails in the Dark. Look, just as time isn't inside clocks, love isn't inside bodies. Bodies only tell the love. Yehuda Amichai. Part 1.
Sign at Wright Historic House. Buried in this small family graveyard are Edmund and Sarah Wright, as well as their eldest child, William. What do you notice about the gravestones? Can you read what's written on them? How do you think these stones might have looked when they were first placed in the ground more than 100 years ago? We ask that you not touch the graves, but please feel free to write a message to the Wrights, let your imagination run wild, and to place it in the box.
1. Let me explain, first of all, that I was never one of those people who believed, even a little bit, in ghosts. I knew people who did. People with office jobs and shoe inserts and wallets stuffed with sandwich punch cards. And I could never quite hide my bewilderment when I realized that they weren't kidding. Even Hannah was ghost curious, although she wouldn't admit it. She used to ask sometimes in her "I promise I won't think less of you" voice whether I'd be willing to sleep alone in a cemetery. Many of these conversations took place during bleary pre-dawn taxi rides, since our route to the airport happened to pass a town-sized cemetery near our apartment. You wouldn't be at all scared. Of course I'd be scared, I'd say. But what I'd be scared of would be that meth addicts might stab me, or that I'd die of frostbite, or that I wouldn't get any sleep because I'd be using a rock for a pillow. This all feels bizarre to think about now, obviously. But if I'm going to tell you this story, then I need to recreate my state of mind from before I knew anything about ghosts, or death, or anything, really. Which means, among other things, revisiting a part of my life that makes me want to curse and weep and pound my forehead with regret. But I can handle it. I'm fairly sure I can handle it. I'll start with the night a couple of years ago, when we were still living in our big, weird apartment in Astoria, and Hannah suggested, in a voice not much different than if she'd been proposing an answer in a crossword puzzle, that we move upstate to a town neither of us had ever heard of. "Look," she said, turning her laptop toward me. "Director, Edmund Wright Historic House, Hibernia, New York. The director of Wright Historic House, WHH, lives on site in a beautifully preserved home from 1750, where he or she is responsible for maintenance of the property as well as the development and implementation of programs for schools and for the general public. Applicant must have background in museums, strong knowledge of 19th century American history, as well as love and appreciation for the Hudson Valley area. Familiarity with maintenance of unique homes, a plus. Unique isn't a good thing when they use it like that," I said. "We could try it. Just see what it's like." "I don't want to know what it's like. I'm going to email them." "Do whatever you want," I said, standing up to gather some dishes I had no intention of washing. The windows were open and a fire truck was screaming its way up 24th Avenue. This was the middle of May, a part of the year in New York when the smells have begun to stew, and no one can believe that spring, all of it, was that one pleasant week in April. Hannah and I were in a relationship tunnel, and it wasn't at all clear to either of us that we'd get out of this one. The problem, one of the problems, was that we'd been together now for 3 years, and she, at 29, had decided, without ever quite saying so, that we either needed to get married or break up. Our fridge had become a collage of other people's save-the-date cards, Our credit card bills went all to flights to cities we didn't want to visit, where we sat sulking in folding chairs and pretended to be surprised when the bride appeared. I knew that I could solve our problems by proposing to her, and I knew that any remotely competent therapist would tell me that my reluctance had nothing to do with Hannah and everything to do with the fiasco of my parents' marriage. But I couldn't. I might, I thought, be one of those people who never get married at all, who argue in a superior tone that the entire thing is an archaic and ridiculous institution. Or I might want very much to get married, just to someone other than Hannah, someone who would render the entire decision simple. Or maybe this present state, this muddled, seasick, doubtful queasiness, was just what it felt like for someone with my particular disposition to want to get married, and I should just get on with it. The upshot, anyway, was that I avoided any subject even tangentially related to marriage, and she ground her teeth that night, and we both dreaded a creamy envelope in the mailbox like the black spot in Treasure Island. "And what, I'd be a farmer?" I said from the kitchen. But another fire truck came roaring after the first one, so she could get away with pretending not to have heard me. A component of our trouble, the thing that had taken our discontent from the back burner and poured it directly onto our laps, was that Hannah had, a few months earlier, been laid off. It happened in winter, during an ice storm on a Friday afternoon. She called me crying from the break room, and my first thought was that one of her parents had died. "Is everything okay?" "No," she said. "She was getting paid off." "Paid off? Bribed?" "Not paid off, you fucking idiot. Laid off. Laid off! Fired!" For 2 years, she'd been working at the New York Historical Society on the Upper West Side, standing an hour a day on the queue, eating $11 salads on Columbus Avenue for lunch. She'd been in their exhibit research department, writing signs and brochures and scripts for the guides to recite while they led tourists through exhibits about New York's ports and Abraham Lincoln. America's most popular president, he is commonly associated with Illinois, where he made his mark as a lawyer, or Kentucky, where he was famously raised in a log cabin. Lesser known is the significant role that New York played in Lincoln's adult life. "This budget has just been a disaster for us," her boss explained. They were sitting in exactly the same positions as when he'd interviewed her. "I wish there was something we could do." We were lucky enough, i.e. we still had enough money from my job and our savings and our families, that Hannah being laid off was not an imminent practical disaster. We would, for a while anyway, be able to pay the rent and buy groceries without scrutinizing per-unit prices and keep our gym memberships. But practical disasters, it turns out, aren't the only kinds of disasters. In the weeks and months afterward, I came to understand, in a way I hadn't really when my acquaintance with people losing their jobs had been mostly via CNN headlines and Raymond Carver stories, why being laid off, even laid off from a job you've enjoyed as opposed to needed, was always high on the list of stressful things that could happen to a person and to a relationship. All of our tensions seemed now to have been dipped in a horrible radioactive juice. Some nights I'd wake up at 3 a.m. with my legs sweating, only to discover that Hannah was awake and sweating too. We were tangled together like sheets of damp saran wrap. The first visible outgrowth of her being laid off was that she decided we should move. She spent a great deal of each day demonstrating via job sites that the only jobs available in her field happened to be outside the five boroughs. Whether to move was, we both understood, a proxy war over whether to get married. This meant that every job offer she came across led to a tense, desolate conversation about something like the housing market in Philadelphia or the lack of public transit in Atlanta. Many nights, as we sat eating dinner, lifting our forks to our faces with the blank, weary expressions of refugees, I had the feeling that we were actors in a play. The end of love, now appearing at the flea, acted with torturous realism by newcomers Hannah Rampe and Nick Barron. I was working then, and had been for the last few years, as an assistant music editor. This meant editing music for movies, mostly mid-budget dramas that I would never have gone to see if I hadn't had anything to do with them. I was the assistant to a thin, bedraggled man named Jeremy, who did all the actual creative work. The composing and the arranging and the watching and re-watching of the same 11-second scene, trying to decide whether the emotional tenor of the moment called for an oboe or a muted trumpet. My contribution was more technical than musical. All day I sat in a semi-darkened room in Midtown, wearing expensive headphones, staring at a 30-inch monitor, adjusting sliders by increments too small to see. My dreams often involved Pro Tools mixing boards, jagged multicolored graphs of sound files. I'd come to editing as a concession. My plan had been, just as Jeremy's plan had been, to become a famous, or anyway a renowned, musician. When I met Hannah, I was just at the tail end of the period in which I believed this might actually happen. I'd made the regular station stops, a band that played talent shows in my Maryland high school, a series of tremblingly self-serious demos recorded on an 8-track, a biweekly appointment at the bar in Ann Arbor that paid in drink tickets. I played guitar and bass and piano and wrote songs that my dad, in a reflective mood, once said reminded him of the Cars. And when I was a couple of years out of Michigan, I put out an album. This seemed briefly to be the success that I'd been dreaming of since I was 12. A record label, now defunct, gave me actual money. I had an album release party. I went on a slightly depressing tour during which I put an incredible number of miles on my Camry. My mom, who'd never quite given up the idea that I should go to business school, sent me a congratulatory bouquet of balloons. Notices were somewhere between respectful and tautological. Nick Barron's Pushing Off is a first album by a new singer-songwriter. An online music magazine I'd only vaguely heard of named me one of that fall's artists to watch. It's hard to say exactly when I decided this wasn't for me. Some of it was the money, and some of it was that I think I'd believed, without ever quite articulating it to myself, that to release an album was to ascend to a celestial plane from which you only returned in order to play sold-out shows at Radio City and to grant enigmatic interviews to Rolling Stone. That you could have an album out and still need to live with four roommates in Long Island City. That my life for the foreseeable future was going to consist of opening for friends' bands and sending out mass email reminders and playing shows for three people in the back rooms of Czech restaurants. I peered down the road and I balked. And music editing didn't feel entirely like a self-betrayal. Although my dad, that year for my birthday, got me a t-shirt with the word sellout printed across the chest. I was making decent money. I was using my musical abilities. I was occasionally attending premieres where people like Susan Sarandon and Jeff Garlin would waft thanks in my general direction. It was, of course, painful to see how little the world mourned the loss of Nick Barron the musician. There were no puzzled queries from disappointed fans, no pleas from record executives, but I was, occasional midnight pangs accepted, doing fine. Just as the function of most furniture is to fill up a room, the function of most jobs is to fill up a life. By the time I met Hannah, it had been a year since I'd last played a show, and I was just becoming practiced at describing myself with just the right mix of irony and self-deprecation as a failed musician. I was 26, with a beard I liked to scratch in moments of intense self-involvement, and round metal glasses whose lenses were perpetually in need of cleaning. I tended, a few minutes into any conversation, to find a way to mention the stars of whatever movie I happened to be working on, always in a tone that suggested that I wasn't entirely sure who they were. That must have been really tough, she said.
Which part?
Well, you said you always wanted to play music. So deciding to go into editing must have felt, I don't know, like you were giving up on yourself, maybe? Is that bad to say?
We had, I want to emphasize, met approximately 20 minutes before this conversation. I delivered versions of my music industry spiel to at least a dozen people, and she was the first one who'd greeted it with anything other than nods of appreciation. This was in the apartment of another assistant music editor named Marissa. She'd invited a dozen people over for dinner to see her new place in Crown Heights. White-painted brick walls, sticky floors, and one of them happened to be Hannah, who she'd known at Oberlin. The rest of the guests were musicians, art teachers, personal assistants, one loud-voiced man who made sure that everyone knew he was just briefly touching down between stints in Berlin. This party was in January, so there was an air of picturesqueness. Soap flakes, snow falling outside, everyone in chunky sweaters. When Hannah and I told the story of our meeting, we always stopped it at that first conversation about music. I'd given an obnoxious speech, she'd insulted me, and the rest was history. But I don't think I really took her in until later. After dinner, we ate spaghetti with capers at a long table that was really a woodworking bench. An activity developed of people trying to light Italian cookie wrappers on fire. The girl who'd brought them said that if you rolled them into a tube and lit them, they'd float up to the ceiling. Hannah was sitting next to me, and we fumbled together with the lighter and the paper, laughing and correcting each other in the way of high school lab partners. She was tall, even sitting down you could tell, with a long neck, dark hair piled on top of her head, dramatic facial angles. Somehow, most of her personality was concentrated in her eyebrows and mouth. Her default expression conveyed a readiness to find something hilarious or ridiculous. These things, she said, watching me fumble with the lighter, are going to blow like Apollo 13. Apollo 13 didn't blow up. It re-entered safely. That's why they made a movie about it. Good to know, she said. She was highly attuned to the male blowhard as a species, for reasons that became obvious as soon as I met her father. She took the lighter from me and leaned over the table to light hers. We sat back, and while the cookie wrappers up and down the table rose in weightless, silent majesty, ours tipped together on their sides and smoldered. When Hannah and I were in our worst period of fighting, I'd sometimes marvel at the fact that we'd somehow gotten from lighting cookie wrappers to sleeping pressed against opposite edges of the bed without there ever being a single day you could point to and say, there, that's where it happened. This is a thing that I'm sure is obvious to everyone else, but is never-endingly astonishing to me. That every change, every life, consists of nothing but a series of days. The shaky old wheelchair-bound man with a blanket on his lap, being hoisted out of the accessoride, was once a bulging, bicepped, turnstile-leaping 20-year-old, and the vessel that carried him all the way from there to here was no bigger than a box on a calendar. Anyway, a few weeks after Hannah showed me the historic house job upstate, which I hoped she'd forgotten about in the same way she'd forgotten about the Indian Museum job in Utah and the Civil Rights Museum job in North Carolina, we had the worst fight we'd ever had. Our neighbor, a fretful single mother named Tina, had knocked on our door to warn us that our air conditioner looked unbalanced, and this had led to an argument about whether I'd installed it right, which had led to an argument about whether she'd paid the electric bill, which had somehow, via a series of steps it would take a forensic pathologist to reconstruct, led to the two of us snarling and shouting at each other across the living room.
You are so fucking afraid of everything, and I don't even think you know it, she said at some point. You just want to stay in the same shitty apartment, living the same shitty life, because it's easy, and it's comfortable, and I just can't fucking do it. You are insane, I remember saying with particular relish. I didn't make you lose your job. I didn't make you sit around all day reading bullshit on Slate. I can't believe I ever wanted to marry you, she hissed.
Well, you're in luck, I said, and I stormed out. I slammed the door, which I don't think I'd really done since I was 14, and I was walking past the train station on Ditmars before it even occurred to me to wonder where I was going. This was a Thursday night, just after 11 o'clock, still hot enough that it was like damp fabric pressed against your skin. This part of Astoria on a summer weeknight is like a stage set after hours. The queue was clattering overhead. An Asian woman in a dirty baseball cap was gathering bottles from a recycling bin in front of the GameStop. I wondered what would happen if I got mugged now, or murdered, how Hannah would find out. I wished I were smoking. I felt from the heat of my breath almost as if I were smoking. My hand was curled around my phone, the way it was perpetually, unconsciously, in half-anticipation of the next dispatch from Hannah. Come home. Don't come home. I love you. I hate you. I pulled it out and turned it to silent. I would, I decided, stop in at Dino's. This was a bar where Hannah and I had gone a couple of times, remarkable in no way except for being 5 minutes from our apartment. Have a drink, fume for a while, then go home and face whatever was next. But by the time I got the bartender's attention, he'd been turned around watching baseball highlights, something strange had started to happen. The grain of the bar stools and the glass of the bottles looked unusually vivid. I felt, before I'd even taken my first sip of Guinness, unusually spacious, as if a drug had just kicked in. I was happy. A handful of men were seated farther down the bar and a group of women at a table in the back. I wanted almost to call out to them. The air conditioning was already cooling the sweat on the back of my shirt, and I realized, touching the foam to my lips, what I was happy about. I was there as a single man. I laughed and knocked the bottom of my glass against the bar, toasting myself. For the first time in years, Hannah had ceased to be my problem. There would be logistics to sort out, details to negotiate, but I didn't need to worry about whether she'd call me or text me, or if she'd still be mad at me tomorrow, or if I'd still be mad at her. Our fight had burned through all that. I was free. And so Dino's, which in any other circumstances would have been the perfect setting for an alcoholic depression, suddenly glowed. The bartender asked me if I needed another. Blessings from a priest. The blue Bombay Sapphire bottle next to the green Jameson bottle. Stained glass in a cathedral. I could live my life as an editor. I could meet someone new, someone sane. I could be happy. How could I not have understood this? Hannah could go off and find some eager idiot who would propose to her on their first anniversary. This thought did give me a slight chill, I admit. And I would get an email from her in a decade, and I'd look up from my desk and think, huh, I haven't thought about her in years. This is how it happens. You can't imagine a person being out of your life until you can't imagine how she ever could have been in your life in the first place. Hannah Rampey. Hannah Rampey. Hannah Rampey. I repeated her name until it became Taffy, a name in the phone book. The man next to me, I hadn't noticed, had been becoming increasingly interested in me over the course of my first couple of drinks. He was stocky, in his 40s, with a band-aid on his thumb and glasses that he kept knuckling back in place. As soon as I gave any indication that I'd seen him, he shifted over onto the stool next to mine. My reverie had found its audience. Except he wasn't going to be an audience. Where is everybody tonight, huh? I mean, yowie, what did I, miss a summit meeting? I'm kidding, my name's Len. How are you doing? His breath smelled like beer and tortilla chips. He had the unmistakable shiftiness of someone who very much wants to tell you something. And what that something was, it turned out, was his ex-wife. Well, actually, she was still technically his wife, but they'd been separated now for 9 months, and she had basically moved in with another guy, so they were as good as divorced.
And could I even imagine what that did to his daughter, seeing her mom with this stranger? 11 years old, an extremely sensitive girl, not your run-of-the-mill kid. This girl eats the ugliest strawberries in the container because she feels bad for them. Imagine how somebody like that would take it. And now he's the one who's not allowed to see her? He's the one? It's sick is what it is. Mental perversion. Every now and then, Len paused to check if I needed another beer, and to be sure I really understood the import of what he was saying. Occasionally, he placed his hand lightly on my wrist, as if to make sure I wouldn't slip away. And did I have any idea what dating was like now? Probably I did, nice-looking guy like me, but sheesh! Everything was all text me, message me. God forbid you should hear someone's voice. And double God forbid you should ever mention your ex, even if the whole point of why you were mentioning her was to explain why you were so glad to be out on this date at all. Usually this place was pretty good, though. One of the better places in the neighborhood. A week ago, he'd talked to the bartender here. A lady bartender, not this one. And that was actually why he'd stopped in tonight, hoping she'd be working. Had I ever seen her, this little Asian girl, tattoo right here? I don't know if it was that I'd passed a threshold of alcohol consumption while Len was talking, or if it was that his words had been perfectly calibrated to have this effect. But the bliss-conferring drug in me had now met its antidote. I didn't register until afterward that I was standing up, rifling through my wallet. I couldn't believe, actually couldn't believe, that until that minute, I'd been thinking I was done with Hannah. Reality came storming back in on 1,000 slippery legs. I murmured apologies to Len, threw my money on the bar, and hurried back out into the heat and clatter of the street. I speed-walked back up Ditmars with that jitteriness in my legs, that sense of unspent adrenaline like when you've nearly been hit by a car. And I did, in fact, come fairly close to being hit by an empty bus. It had been, according to the clock on my phone, on which I'd missed a call from Hannah at 12:09 a.m., a little more than an hour since I'd walked out our door. 2 blocks from our corner, I broke into a run. I let myself into our apartment quietly, my heart kicking, expecting to find Hannah cross-legged, her jaw set, the computer glowing in her lap. I was braced for us to pick up right where we'd left off, shouts and curses, and the realization that I really would be looking for a new apartment in the morning. Maybe she'd felt the same freedom I had, only without the reversal. Or maybe she'd already gone to her parents and she'd been calling to tell me goodbye. I was ready, or I wasn't at all ready, but I thought I needed to be, for Hannah, the only woman I'd ever actually loved, that was so clear now, to walk out of my life completely. But the apartment was quiet, still, and inhabited. I pushed open the door to our bedroom, and Hannah was under the sheets on her side, her iPhone and Poe Bronson's What Should I Do With My Life arrayed next to her on the bed. Our bed. It could have been an illustration in a storybook called Happy Home. There was my bedside table, and there was our fan humming softly away on the dresser. And there was the painting of a bridge that we'd bought at that yard sale in Pennsylvania. There was what I should do with my life. In gratitude, I whimpered audibly, and she murmured something. She wasn't mad anymore. All that was done. Of course. She'd cooled off, she'd called me, she'd gone to sleep. The dramatic action, as ever, had taken place entirely in my skull cavity. I showered, twice as long as usual, to get the remnants of bar stickiness off me, then climbed in next to her, trying not to disturb the mattress. She adjusted her body to let me hold her. "I love you so much," I whispered into the warm, white shell of her ear. My mouth, which had a few hours earlier been sputtering with fury, now felt newborn, Listerine in love. Hannah said, pulling my arm over her, which was easier than rousing herself to the layer of consciousness at which she could have said something. I'm serious, I said. I've been such an idiot.
Mm-hmm,
she said, more emphatically. I'm so sorry.
You're drunk.
I'm not. I love you. She knocked my hand gently against her chest, a gesture of love and forgiveness and a plea for me to shut up and go to sleep. But I couldn't. I shook her shoulder. I don't care if you can't find a job here. We can move. I can quit. We can do anything. I was Scrooge on Christmas morning. Len, muttering about Asian girls while he plucked at his Band-Aid, had been my ghost of Christmas future. We could get married, have kids, make a life together. It wasn't too late. I'm serious, I said. You should apply for that job. I could tell from the angle of her head that she was awake now, listening. The clock by our bedside said it was 1:16. The one upstate, the house. We could just try it for a while. I can write music again. It would be an adventure. She rolled onto her back.
I have a secret,
she said in the groggy voice of someone whose eyes are closed. For a terrible second, my inner floor collapsed. She'd already found a new apartment. She'd been cheating on me. It was too late. No, she pressed my hand below her collarbone.
I applied on Tuesday, she said. I have a phone interview next week.
FAQ for teachers. Write Historic House teaching materials. What is this place, anyway? The Wright Historic House is a museum dedicated to educating the public about Edmund Wright, the distinguished 19th century writer and philosopher. But WHH is much more than just another history museum. It also happens to be the very house where Edmund Wright and his family spent many years of their lives. When you walk in the door at WHH, you are literally stepping into history. How long did the Wrights live here? Why Hibernia? In 1866, Edmund Wright and his family moved to Hibernia from New York City, and they remained here in the house until Sarah's death in 1903. The Wrights came to Dutchess County in search of a more natural life for themselves and their young children. Like many Americans of his era, Edmund Wright had become disillusioned with the increased mechanization and speed of modern life, and he hoped that in Hibernia he would discover a calmer, simpler way of being, just as many visitors to the area still do today. What did Edmund do while living at WHH? An easier question to answer might be, what didn't he do while living at WHH? Edmund Wright can be thought of as the original Dutchess County jack of all trades. In addition to teaching himself the basics of farming and studying his beautiful natural surroundings, he wrote many works of lasting importance in philosophy and psychology, including his famous and unfinished encyclopedias, which you and your class can see in Wright's own handwriting right here in the museum. While living at WHH, Wright published more than a dozen books and tens of articles, not to mention writing thousands of pages of letters and journal entries. No wonder one publication of his era dubbed him the Human Rotary Press. Did he believe in the occult? I've heard strange stories about the house, and I am concerned. Unfortunately, Wright, like many great figures throughout history, has seen his reputation negatively impacted by exaggerations and in some cases flat-out untruths. After the tragic death of the Wright's eldest son William in 1869, Edmund, like many grieving parents, sought comfort by imagining an afterlife. But there is no reason to believe this brief flirtation impacted the rational pursuits for which he is known. In the 19th century, the line between science and the supernatural was not so clear as it is today. Even Charles Darwin, the father of evolution, expressed curiosity about what people might nowadays call the occult. In many ways, science was still like a toddler, only just learning to walk. As for stories that you or your students may have heard about the house itself, imagine all that you would have seen if you had been alive for more than 250 years. Certainly this house has seen its share of sorrows, but it has also seen many joys. Our hardworking staff members have spent countless hours here at WHH, and we can assure you that none of them has ever heard anything more unusual than the occasional creak or the sound of a mouse in the walls. Even as we respect the sometimes strong feelings and concerns of our visitors, we also feel it is important to maintain a sense of humor about the quirks that come with working in such a special place. That's why, if you enjoy your visit, we would like to invite you and your class to come back in October for our Spooky Halloween Festival to join in an all-in-good-fun day of storytelling and themed craft activities.
Winter, 1985, New York, age 4. You are sitting on the living room floor by the edge of the rug, tangled white tassels. Your cat sits by your knee, staring at a spot of sunlight on the floorboard. He tilts his head. You touch his neck. He's purring, not a sound, but a buzz. You close your eyes. You try to purr. Then you feel, by a shift in the floor, that your dad is standing behind you. There he is, his legs. You look up, his hair standing up on the sides, his blue sweatshirt, his socks with a hole in the toe. He sips too loudly from a black mug, American Academy of Ophthalmology. His glasses hold white squares of light that move when he moves. He says, "And what are you doing with this beautiful day, my darling?" No matter what you answer, he's going to say, "That's a lovely thing for a little girl to do." He'll lean over, smell of coffee and morning and rough cheeks, and then he does. He leans over, the cat darts off, the buzz is gone. You are sitting on the living room floor.
Two. Hannah's phone interview led to an in-person interview, led to a job offer with what might have been, if we'd been in a more skeptical frame of mind, alarming speed. But the force of my barstool conversion did not, surprisingly, dissipate in the weeks afterward. Breaking out of a relationship tunnel is every bit as astonishing and every bit as convincing as being stuck in one. I told Jeremy, my boss, that I was leaving even before Hannah had officially been offered the job. He didn't seem so much furious as I'd feared he would be, as mildly annoyed, as if I'd mislabeled a clip. We were wrapping up one movie, starting on another in a few weeks. "Hey, look, it's your call," he said. "Into the great blue yonder. I hope it works out. Just get me back that cut by the end of next week." The decision to propose to Hannah, finally, hardly felt like a decision at all. What we'd been having was the storm before the calm. I'd seen friends go through it, packing up their clothes, going on internet dates, and then, 6 months later, standing hand in hand with their old girlfriends with tears of joy in their eyes. It was part of the ritual. I proposed at a tiny French restaurant in the East Village. That was, despite the vanishing waiters and the wobbling chairs, our favorite place in the city. It was narrow and hot, and the tables, lit by flickering tea lights, were so close together that you touched elbows with the strangers next to you. It was the sort of place where couples were always having to disentangle their hands in order for the waiter to set down the food. Something they don't tell you about proposing is that the act itself, even in cases of minimal suspense, is fairly awkward. Directors cut to the woman's string of ecstatic yeses at precisely the moment when, in actual life, you, kneeling like a knight, sweating behind your knees, realize that this, the most meaningful speech of your life so far, is unfolding as a series of sentence fragments and saliva swallows. Hannah pulled me to my feet. I lost my balance and came uncomfortably close to tipping over our neighbor's table, and we kissed, standing, while everyone in the restaurant clapped and cheered. Moving, after this, was nothing. There were still times in the middle of the night when I'd roll onto my back and think, the rest of our lives, or health insurance, but these were residue, bubbles working their way out of the system. Suddenly, there were as many reasons to marry and to move as there had been a couple of months earlier to stew and to stay. The Wright House only asked for a 1-year initial commitment, for one thing. In winter, the museum was only open a day or two a week. It would be our rite of passage, the threshold we passed through on our way to married life. And I was, the more I thought about it,
convinced that the thing that had throttled my musical ambitions had been the city. How could I possibly have honed my craft in a place where the guy next to you on the train is on his way to Lincoln Center to play with Wynton Marsalis? It can be your Bon Iver cabin, Hannah said one night. I'm going to pretend you didn't say that. This would, anyway, be my period of professional woodshedding and personal nonsense dispensing. Hannah would get some experience at running something, maybe finally do some writing. We would learn what it meant to live together, to rely on each other as an actual couple instead of as two vaguely hostile roommates. I can't wait to use the fireplace. I've always thought I could be someone who gets into birding. We should buy a hammock. We should buy hiking boots. Some of our readiness to leave may have been New York's doing, too. No city has ever been so cooperative in providing exit music for the uncertain. There was, one night on the N train, a puddle of spam-colored vomit spread from pole to pole, with shoe prints. There was a deep, gut-rumbling alarm that sounded from the power plant near our apartment for an hour one morning. There was a prune-sized cockroach that skittered out from behind the coffee machine. Vomit, power plants, cockroaches. I leave the city to you. I'll be with my beloved and my guitar on a 15-acre farm. Hannah and I drove 2 hours up the Taconic for her in-person interview on a sun-scrubbed Thursday. The scenery nailed its role. In Hannah's old college Volvo, we sped through a crazy dark bounty of trees, over gleaming reservoir lakes, past hay bales and wooden fences, and sculpture-still pecan-colored horses. "Smell that," Hannah said, rolling down the window. "I know," I said. "It's crazy. I wonder if they put drugs in the air." Unless Hannah had been assaulted during the interview, it was conducted at the house by a 60-something board member whose main concern was whether Hannah knew of any art museums in the city that might be interested in giving his niece an internship. I don't think either one of us would have considered her turning down the job. The remoteness of the museum, the lack of visitors, the apparent lack of other candidates. These were, we hardly even needed to assure each other, not problems at all. They were challenges. They were curiosities. They were virtues in feeble disguise. A mind made up is a formidable thing. How can I tell you about the Rampies? Our last night in the city, this was the end of August, the only things left in our apartment were an arrow bed and a box of Thin Mints. We had dinner with Hannah's parents. It was hot, but not gruesome. An emptied out, leave work early and sit dazed on a boulder in Central Park feeling to the city. We had dinner with the Rampies once a month or so, but this was only the second time we'd seen them since getting engaged, and they were determined to make it momentous. A send-off. And also a compensation for the last time, which had been the kind of hard-to-pin-down disappointment that was Hannah's parents' specialty. The Rampies didn't like me. This was the simplest and maybe the most accurate way to put it, but it wasn't the way Hannah and I tended to put it when we put it anyway at all. It isn't that they don't like you, it's that... It was that they'd seen Hannah's older sister Megan go through such a series of relationship disasters. At 33, she'd been divorced already and was now living in Providence with a man they were fairly sure had stolen Terry's pain pills from the medicine cabinet. Or it was that they didn't know what to make of my sense of humor. Hannah's dad, Bruce, grimaced whenever people other than himself made jokes, as if he were recovering from a punch to the abdomen. In any event, our get-togethers tended to be festivals of stillborn conversations and strained smiles. My charms, which had paid my way through most of my life, were not accepted here. Terry was in her early 60s, thin and unsure of herself. She had dark hair and Hannah's nose and a quick, quiet voice. She was always calling Hannah because she needed help signing into her bank account. or because she was certain she'd bought theater tickets, but somehow they'd disappeared. She'd worked in publishing before Hannah was born, then in PR, then doing research for a historian. I always thought I was just about to find what my thing was going to be. But now she seemed mainly to make plans and to worry. Bruce was an eye surgeon. This was the first and possibly the only thing he thought you needed to know about him. He took yearly trips to Tanzania, where he performed free surgeries for village kids, who then hung grinning from his biceps in photos. He jogged a loop of Central Park each morning, and was under the impression that their building's doorman, "That's all you run in today, Mr. R," was personally fond of him. He had a full head of gray hair and pink skin, and he interacted with everyone, including his offspring, in a way that managed to convey, "I'm going to do you the favor of listening hard to what you're saying right now, but please understand that the meter is running." The Rampys had lived for 35 years in the same apartment on the Upper West Side, and they were both dedicated to New York in a way that bordered on the cultish. They knew someone in the city who excelled at every human endeavor. The best tailor, the best butcher, the best off-Broadway theater director, the best guy to talk to if you needed curtains. When they went on vacations, every couple of years they took a 2-week trip to somewhere like Morocco or New Zealand. It was only to refill their store of fanaticism. "Is there a rule against putting ice in the water?"
"You know what your mother pointed out after we'd been there a couple of days? No one was sitting in the parks. They're just empty."
When Hannah first told her parents that we were engaged, they had only just absorbed the fact that we'd be moving upstate. Terry said,
"Wait, you weren't on speaker. What did you say?" "Nick and I are engaged."
"To be married?"
"Yes,"
I heard Bruce's voice in the background.
"Since when?"
They took us out to a celebratory dinner at Il Buco, the best Italian restaurant, that was slightly, but only slightly, more successful than the phone call. Bruce, after some conversation about when we wanted the wedding to be, we didn't know, and whether we thought it made sense to be taking on so much change at once, we did, got into an argument with the waiter about whether there were enough shrimp in his pasta. This was how nights with them went. Awkward jousting, expensive food, and then Hannah at some point afterward asking,
"Why can't they just be normal with you?"
But her parents were not, Hannah would regularly insist, as difficult as they seemed. They'd come around. They were just protective. They loved her absurdly. And it was true. They did. My own parents, by comparison, were as involved in my life as an uncle and aunt. My mom, when I told her that Hannah and I were engaged, said,
"Oh, that's great news. We just love her. Love her."
And then asked if she could call me back because she was about to pull into the garage. So there was something I envied for all the unpleasantness in the closeness of the Rampys. They regarded Hannah as in need of special protection, and they were going to be the ones who provided it. I even understood why. This is a tricky area. I feel edging up to it like I'm walking a crumbly edged trail on the lip of the Grand Canyon. I can't tell how much of this is hindsight, but the story fluoresces now. It seems like the most important thing I ever learned about the Rampys. In any event. When Hannah was just out of Oberlin, she had a kind of breakdown. She didn't tell me about this until we'd been together for about a year, and even after she had told me about it, she only ever referred to it in the most general terms.
"When I was having a hard time after college. When that stuff happened."
It was a chapter excised from the history books, reduced to a single, uninformative paragraph. What had happened, so far as I could tell, was that an ordinary but stressful set of experiences, the sudden death of a cousin, a bad boss, some complicated falling out with a friend, had all come in quick succession, and she had, in a way she'd never done before, cracked. Skipping work to weep in bed, going out to dinners with friends and then partway through feeling so suddenly and inexplicably terrified that she would stand up and run back to her apartment, her heart racing. For a while, she couldn't sleep because she was afraid she'd stop breathing in the night, so she would call her parents and keep the phone next to her on the pillow. This was when she was living in the West Village with a roommate, working at a law office. There may have been mild delusions. She'd told me about her ceiling pulsating, her curtains seeming to flap at her. But some of these may have had to do with drugs. Her roommate, seeing what a bad time she was having, had convinced her to take mushrooms, which had only pushed the meltdown into a new and direr phase. The upshot was that she quit her job and broke her lease and spent a few months at home, trembling in bed, being dragged by her parents from one therapist to another, suddenly a child again at 23, only more helpless than when she'd actually been a child. Bruce and Terry were at their best in a crisis, apparently. Cool washcloths pressed against her forehead, Cary Grant marathons on TMC. Bruce eventually got her an appointment with a psychiatrist he knew from med school, Dr. Blythe. And he ended up being the savior. He prescribed her a combination of pills and talk that, over the next couple of months, brought her to a state where she was exhausted but not miserable, and just as puzzled by what had happened to her as everyone else was. She found a new apartment. This was when she got her first job in a museum. By the time I met her, you would never have guessed she'd had any sort of psychological trouble at all. She projected a capable, cheerful ease in the world. It would have been easier to believe that she'd founded a company in her 20s than that she'd had a breakdown. But for her parents, of course, the memory was still close. To have watched your child collapse is to live the rest of your life on a partially frozen pond. So their wariness about me may have made a certain kind of animal sense. Their daughter had demonstrated the capacity for sudden plunges, and I had not yet proven myself capable of picking her up. Anyway, that night in August, we grilled hamburgers out on the deck of their apartment and watched the sun set showily over New Jersey. Bruce and Terry were arguing in their repartee mode about Terry having forgotten to buy cayenne for the corn. Their dog, a fat black cocker spaniel named Mickey, who had a regimen of pills much more extensive than Hannah's, kept wandering between our ankles, hoping for scraps. "A toast to your engagement," Bruce said, lifting up a strikingly full glass.
"And to starting to think about wedding dates and venues and all that fun stuff," Terry said, clinking carefully.
The main thread of conversation kept returning, despite Hannah's best efforts, to how much they'd miss us once we moved. Terry inched her chair closer to Hannah's and said,
"You realize, I hope, that you're going to have to call us the second you get there. I can't stand driving on the Taconic. After the last time, I said I'd never do it again. And just thinking of you two with the car all loaded up and all these other drivers weaving around."
Bruce kept going inside to adjust the volume on the stereo. Whenever conversation wasn't aimed at him directly, he kept himself in a state of restless bustle, making sure the burgers didn't need to be turned, plucking dead leaves out of the plants by the railing.
"A patient of mine has a house not far from Hibernia," he said, coming back outside. 29 minutes, I looked it up. You ought to get together for a meal."
He was still wearing his blue biking outfit from a ride that afternoon. Whenever he came near, I got a whiff of low tide.
"I'm sure your 70-year-old patient is dying to have dinner with his doctor's daughter and her fiancé."
The word fiancé still had a certain unsheathed blade effect on her parents.
"He's 59, for your information," Bruce said, recovering himself.
"Wouldn't it be nice to know someone up there?" Terry said. "That's the part I always found scary about moving, the not knowing anyone."
We'd finished dinner, and I was in the kitchen refilling my water glass, mentally congratulating myself on having gotten through the night. In the pantheon of rampy dinners, this had been fairly painless. when Bruce walked in behind me and let the door swing shut. I realized I'd been set up, stalked like a deer. "So," he said, zipping and unzipping one of the pockets on his shirt. "You've probably noticed we're a bit stirred up." "Are you?" I said. "I know this is a big deal." We were standing a few feet apart, not quite looking at each other. "Let me just get to the point. Hannah's our priority. You don't understand what that means yet, but you will. Megan is too, of course, but you understand why this might all be a little more intense with Hannah." I nodded solemnly. He stepped closer and put his hands on the edge of the island and lowered his head, like a boxer between rounds. What he said next didn't sound like him. Normally his voice had an eyebrow-wobbling, ironic quality. Hannah called it his "Oh, do you" voice, but now all smugness, all playfulness was gone. He spoke quickly and quietly. "You're taking her off somewhere, just the two of you. You're talking about getting married. Things are feeling pretty good right now. I know you think you know her well. You guys have been together a few years, but I want you to know she's trickier than that. She seems very sure of herself, but that's taken work. That's not an accident. If this moving upstate doesn't work out, or if you decide, well, what do you know, maybe marriage isn't the thing, she'll take it harder than you can probably imagine. And you won't be the one who picks up the pieces." He cleared his throat, seeming to sense that he'd gone too far. "Look, Terry and I just want her to have a happy life. Good husband, good family, all the standard stuff. We just want to be sure you get that." I didn't know if I was being warned or cursed or what exactly. My face was burning, and a part of me wanted to march out onto the deck and grab Hannah by the arm and storm out of these lunatics' lives forever. Instead, I swallowed and told him that I understood. "I'm glad," he said, putting his hand on my back and guiding us out into the living room. "That's very good." We all said elaborate goodbyes in the front hall.
"You'd better go already or I'll start crying," Terry said, already crying.
And on the subway ride home, Hannah, resting her head on my shoulder, said,
"What did my dad say to you in the kitchen?"
"Just to be careful on the drive because of cops." The next morning, thanks to nerves and a leak in our aerobed, Hannah and I woke up before the alarm. I'd just had a dream involving climbing a sand dune. We lay for a few minutes in that cobwebby, pre-verbal state, not talking. The light in the room, our soon-to-be former bedroom, was blue. The street outside was the quietest I'd ever heard it.
"You feel like manifesting a move?" Hannah finally said.
This was a phrase I'd almost forgotten. We'd heard a blonde, dreadlocked woman say it a few years before on the phone in an incense-stinking birthstone and beads store on Bleecker Street. She'd been manifesting a move to Brazil, wondering when the universe would start sending her signs of compliance. "I do," I said, my heart, possibly just for reasons of morning system's bulkiness, had started knocking around in my chest like a trapped squirrel. "Do you?"
"I do," she said, sitting up. "The vibrations have commenced."
Farewell Kiss. Wright Historic House Teaching Materials. Once there was a man named Edmund Wright. He lived in New York City when it was much smaller than today, but still a very big city. He had a happy family, and he liked his job, which was writing books. But he always had a bad feeling that something was going to happen to his oldest son, William, whom he loved more than anything in the world. Sometimes he would have dreams where William would fall out a window. Sometimes he would just be sitting at his desk, and out of nowhere, he would imagine William getting trampled by a horse. So one day, when Edmund had had enough of being scared, he decided to move his family out of the city and up to a little town called Hibernia. He was sure that William would be safe there. And sure enough, life was good in Hibernia. Edmund and his family ate vegetables from their garden and went for walks in the beautiful woods. I feel as sturdy as one of these oak trees, said Edmund. For the first time in years, he had some peace of mind. But one foggy fall evening, Edmund decided to go into town to visit a friend. He hitched up his horse